Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it and put it on your iPod, iPad, computer, whenever you want to listen to it. Today we have a real interesting show, which I'm thrilled to finally be doing. We've talked about it enough, and today we announced the launch of a side project of mine, which two law students, Hunter McMahon, based in Southern California, and Alex Schusterman, who's a law student here in Pittsburgh, have literally been slaving away for the past 3 months coding to make this website possible. It's lawblogreview.org, and they weren't coding in the way we typically mean in e-discovery. They've actually been doing software coding to create the website, and the goal is to enable law students to take electronic discovery courses or who have a strong technical background to promote themselves nationally and make themselves available for law firms as law clerks, which thereby addresses the lack of sophistication among smaller law firms who struggle with e-discovery because they typically don't have anyone with a strong background in the field to help them, and their clients address the field, and they don't typically have the money. So I'm thrilled that we have a special guest with Judge Grimm joining us on the show, as he's been a very visible advocate for increased education of e-discovery concepts at law schools. He's taught at two programs. He's been an educator of lawyers through his opinions, which are cited for their detail and roadmaps to help lawyers learn what they should and shouldn't do with e-discovery. And I'm also thrilled that Judge Shinlin from the Southern District of New York has joined us briefly on the show. She has another commitment, but we have two of the judges that everyone cites to in this field for really helping advance the cause of the field, and glad they could join us, as well as I mentioned, Hunter McMahon and Alex Schusterman. I also want to mention Judge Facciola wanted to join us on this program, but he had another commitment, but he's very interested in this project. So first of all, why don't we start off with you, Judge Shinlin. Why do you think this is important to get law students engaged in the field who have technical backgrounds?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me, and I'm always so pleased to be on any program that Judge Grimm is on because he is the leader in the field. So it's my honor to be on the program with you. It's so important that law students learn something about e-discovery because they are the present and the future. Those young lawyers will bring so much to the law firms that is not available now. My view is technology is better understood the younger you are. It's like a foreign language. The younger you learn it, the more you understand it. So as the new blood that graduates law school comes to the firms, I won't have to hear in court any longer words like, well, I don't understand that, I'll have to call my consultant. I don't understand that, I'll have to talk to an IT person. What do you mean by concept searching? I never heard of that. We want to get past that. We want to have lawyers in court who can respond to a judge's question about how best to handle a search, how to do it most efficiently, most inexpensively, and with best results. And until we can educate law students so that when they become lawyers, they understand those issues, we're not able to get the responses we want to hear. And then we end up having to, unfortunately for us, write opinions critical of lawyers who didn't do what they should do. So education is always the answer when people are failing to perform up to a certain level. And I look to the next generation to improve the practice within law firms in terms of understanding e-discovery. I just want to add one final thought on that, which is, in my view, all discovery going forward is e-discovery. We've moved on. Records are not created any longer in handwriting or on a typewriter. All records are created electronically. Every business, every hospital, every college or graduate school, everybody is creating records electronically. So we all have to cope with that reality. It's no longer a specialty e-discovery. It is discovery. So I hope that wasn't too long an answer, and I'd be so interested to hear what Judge Grimm says, but that's my answer to that first question.
Great. And Judge Grimm, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, yes, of course. And as has been the case really since the courts first grappled with e-discovery issues. Judge Shindlin has said it first and best, and she could not be more correct. This is an area where we have been reminded of a truism that has always been around, but it has been more prominent, and that is that the law always lags technological developments. And because, with the possible exception of a post-it note or a spray-painted graffiti on a wall someplace, everything these days is generated and stored in a digital or electronic format, Judge Shindlin is absolutely correct that all discovery is, with the exception of a deposition and things that don't involve documents, is going to be essentially digital and electronic. It's also true that the technology changes. I remember 3 or 4 years ago first hearing of something called Twitter, and I remember thinking to myself, isn't that silly? Why would somebody use Twitter? There's text messages and emails, and of course, if you take a look at the impact that Twitter has had, and you just look around the world right now in terms of the last 6 months, the changes that have occurred, and using Twitter and another relatively new phenomenon, Facebook, social media, you see how quickly how technology changes and integrates itself into the way in which ordinary people conduct themselves, whether it's business, whether it is a personal, whether it's legal or illegal. So you cannot avoid it. It's there. And Judge Shindlin is absolutely correct. The way to resolve disputes inherently deals with the important issues of how we litigate cases. The concerns of the courts, and Judge Shindlin has expressed it best and most often to remind people that for the courts to live up to their goal of providing a forum that is effective and proportionally allows disputes to be resolved so that the cost of getting to the answer is proportional to what's at issue without sacrificing fairness, you have to take advantage of technology and make technology the source of the solution, not the problem. And when you have disputes that occur so often, when lawyers come into court who do not understand the technology, and so you have disputes over whether or not the parties recognized a duty to preserve, whether or not the parties met to develop a discovery plan, whether or not they talked about issues associated with the form of production, whether they negotiated to have a non-waiver agreement so that they could use digital searching, concept searching, electronic searching to lower the cost. When people argue about how you have not properly tried to process the discovery, you haven't searched for all people who have produced it, or that you have to save or produce information from sources that are not reasonably accessible without undue burden and cost, what these lawyers display is that they have a disconnect between the way in which they have approached the problem solving from the facts that are necessary in order to do it. And as a result of this, because we are all reluctant and sometimes afraid to jump into new technology, there's almost an inherent fear among lawyers of a certain age, myself included, to embrace discovery and to focus in on how it can be used as part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And so it is vitally important, because I couldn't agree more with Judge Shindlin as well, that there is a clear age demarcation between the people who feel most comfortable and most proficient with digital platforms and electronic information. And people above a certain age, it is something new to them. They worry about what they're doing. It doesn't have inherent sense. And so that not only is it vital for the law itself to have people with the technical proficiency to deal with this, but clients will expect it. And the ability of lawyers to get and maintain good client relationships is enhanced when they know how to produce the service for the client in the litigation or the negotiation that recognizes the technological reality of how the client operates. And so it is, at root, lawyers are expected by their clients to be problem solvers, not problem creators. And there is, and you can't do that if you don't understand the technological platforms in which it occurs.
Can I just add one thing before I sign off? Because I'm sorry, I'm going to have to drop off the call and return to court. But I do want to say that from our perspective, Judge Grimm and myself, these issues are coming up every day in the courtroom. I had one just yesterday in a very large and complex case where the lawyers were clearly lost, and they kept saying, until I can go back and talk to my outside consultant, I can't answer the simplest question that Your Honor has, which is really going to become unacceptable. So when we advance to the point where the lawyer in the courtroom understands the technology, it's going to be better for clients. As Judge Grimm said, it's going to be less expensive, it's going to be more efficient, and it's just going to be quicker. So this happens every day in my courtroom, that something about electronic discovery comes up willy-nilly in case after case. So I do want the students who hear this particular program to understand that this is very immediate. There will be a niche for them. There will be a need for them. And we're pleased that so many schools are now beginning to pay attention to this and are educating law schools in this area. With that, I apologize, but I have to get off the call. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you,
thank you,
Judge.
Very much, Judge Shinlin. And I should mention Judge Shinlin's written a textbook to help law schools teach e-discovery that we talked about a number of episodes ago. And, you know, so there's certainly tools out there for law schools that aren't yet teaching it to help their students, you know, join this growing field.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Judge Grimm, one of the reasons I focused in this area early on, in fact, the first podcast ESI Bytes did was to focus on the gaps of knowledge between larger firms and small firms. Are you still seeing a gap in knowledge? Do you get cases where you have people at smaller firms that just are totally clueless in this area? Because I know Judge Facciola really was concerned about this a few years ago.
Well, I think it is a somewhat artificial question to say, is it firm size that equates to competence or lack of competence on technical issues? It is, to me, highly ironic that it is the computer that has, I think, leveled the playing ground between what in 20 years ago was the enormous firms with a lot of resources who were considered to be the ones that the most complicated and interesting cases had to be brought to. Now, as a result of access to digital information, computer research, the efficiencies that people using litigation support software can do, small firms can be highly competitive. They can compete oftentimes at lower price points, and lawyers with experience and with talent can be very much like Sir Francis Drake in the Spanish Armada. You have these great big huge galleons, and you have the small maneuverable British fleet that absolutely had them tied up in knots. So I think it's a mistake to look at the difference between size. I do think that if you have a person who is a general practitioner who does not do a lot of litigation, who has maybe a practice that deals with real estate, who also commercial transactions and maybe some collection work and some personal injury claims and maybe family law matters, these are very, very, very important lawyers because they provide bread and butter legal services that at a rate that's affordable by many people. But if you are a generalist, then if you jump into a case where suddenly you have issues such as preservation, form of production, privilege review, and you are in court answering the kinds of questions put to you by Judge Shinlin, it is often the case that someone without the time to sort of specialize in this area is going to be a little bit in a battle of wits unarmed. I have also seen big cases where you walk into court and you've got two partners and three associates and 12 paralegals, and that's just sitting at the counsel table. And then in the rank behind that, you've got battalions of other support staff there as well. And the people who have actually have the knowledge of it are not the people sitting at council table, because the named partner or the senior partner has to have the ego stroking of standing up in court and talking, and they don't know any more than their adversary may know. So I think it's a mistake to talk about size of firm. I think it's more appropriate to talk about awareness of the importance of the technical information to getting the job done. And while there may very well be within large firms specialty sections that deal with ESI-related matters, they're not always brought in, and they're not always brought in and viewed as welcome by the other litigators. And sometimes they're viewed with skepticism because they come in and start telling litigators who may not want to hear it, hey, you've got a duty to preserve. You've got to issue a litigation hold. You've got to know what you're doing here. And that's not always welcome news. So I think it's a false discriminator to talk about size. I think that the correct thing, and Judge Fasciola could not be more correct, when he talks about the need for, and as does Judge Shindlin, the need for competence. And I think, echoing what Judge Shindlin said a moment ago before she had to return to court, is that this is an area where, in a tough market, where law students graduating, coming out and wanting to be able to distinguish themselves, can immediately launch their career ahead. Because if they come forward and say, I understand this stuff, I can be your go-to person on these issues, then that's going to launch them ahead and make them more visible than the intervening levels of more senior associates and junior partners who don't have this skill. Because when it's recognized that this has to be known, then they're going to look for the person who can deliver. And if you have that skill set, and if you've taken an ESI course that familiarizes you both with the legal framework in which these issues come up and also allow you to showcase your technological knowledge, I can't think of a better career enhancer than that.
So now let's turn the focus onto the site itself. And Judge Grimm, if you have questions about the site, feel free to chime in and ask. But Hunter, why don't we start off, how does LawBlog Review help facilitate making trainee discovery law clerks available for law firms that might be interested in hiring them as law clerks?
Well, I think, our goal with LawBlog Review is kind of multifold, one for the law student and one for the practitioner. So first, for the law student, e-discovery has, it's gone past the filing cabinet, it's gone past the one office location, and now it's, dare we touch on the cloud issue. But it's all over. So with that in mind, we're kind of saying, okay, let's get a website going where students from all schools and all avenues, whether you're teaching a course based on one book or another book or a series of cases or a series of resources, they can get together and really network and bounce ideas and learn from each other's experiences. Everybody's experience in the background, albeit maybe technical, may have a different type of experience. Maybe they were more in the management of IT versus the actual writing of coding. So being able to network amongst students and having what we want to say is a secure or a no-fault environment to where you can ask those simple questions when you're first getting into it, so you can understand the intricacies of e-discovery rather than just from a 30,000-foot view from a generic, you read a couple articles, now you understand e-discovery. So really getting people's experience and letting law students network amongst each other to be able to really facilitate an open forum and gain each other's insights. On the other hand, for practitioners, we want the students to be exposed. So one of the greatest recognitions through law school is publication. We want to give law students a forum to where they can be published, whether it's, a full article that's, 30, 40, 50 pages long, or whether it's a 3-page case summary from a recent decision that we think is, should be highlighted and practitioners should at least know is a recent, very impactful decision. So now you're bridging the gap from, or at least what we hope, is from law students to practitioners and giving practitioners a great resource to feed off of law students that want to be recognized that want to learn and that want to get out there and learn off each other, for practitioners to benefit from the summaries and the experience that they have from a technical side and be able to make themselves more marketable in the end. It's, you know, it's everything from we want to be able to allow students to post their resumes or profile online so law practitioners can understand their backgrounds better and what they have to add to electronic discovery rather than just, you know, a footnote on the resume, by the way, I have technical experience. Establishing a reputation amongst the website to where if you're looking for a job and you're being able to say, look, I've been involved in e-discovery for the last, you know, 6 months, 2 years, or 3 years as a law student, I'd really encourage you to take a look at the different postings that I've made and the impacts and the practitioners that I've worked with or at least provided resources to. Here's the links and here's the information. I think it's a great resource and a great experience factor. And as Judge Grimm was saying, you know, having the actual attorneys being able to understand this coming out of law school rather than having, you know, a consultant or somebody else on the outside that you have to call every time that you want to answer a question is very advantageous. So getting that experience and in that networking environment really on a national level rather than just a university level, I think is going to be, you know, invaluable.
I thought of a question I'd like to ask Alex. You two have already experienced this to some extent of working together on this project. I mean, Alex is here in Pittsburgh where it just snowed, because I'm in Pittsburgh too, and you're off on the West Coast enjoying something a lot nicer, I think. But you've had a chance over the last four months or so to work on this together. Alex, how's that been like, sort of collaborating with someone on the other end of the country? Bouncing ideas about, you know, e-discovery and how to make the site work.
In terms of actual logistics, it's really not that big a deal. You know, we talk on the phone. I mean, the biggest issue is time difference, obviously. But as somebody who's still in law school and who is trying to break into the e-discovery field, it's been phenomenal for me to be able to talk to Hunter as somebody who's already in the field and working while he's in law school as well. And as far as that goes, I've learned a lot. And in that time, and just coding the website and finding, you know, content to put on it, I've learned an immense amount of information. And, you know, I can't imagine what it would be like having that many more people involved with the site.
So how do you get started with the site, Alex? I mean, what do you need to if you're a law student to get involved?
To get involved, there's a couple things you can do. You can go directly to the website and click on the law student section and request an account with us. By requesting an account, it lets, you know, Hunter and I know that there's somebody who's interested and we can contact you to sort of get a feel for what your experience is, what you're looking to do, and how involved you want to be. I mean, right now, Law Blog Review is the Hunter and Alex show. You know, we are running the site design. We are soliciting content. We're doing everything. And, you know, that's fine for now, but it's going to flounder if it's just us. And to get involved, the best way is just to get in touch with one of us through the website or by requesting an account. Any of that works.
Well, that's music to my ears. When I came with the idea, I didn't want it to be the Carl show, so that's great. And how can listeners help Hunter? I mean, what would you suggest to them? Can they contact law schools? I mean, law students, what ideas do you have?
You know, the biggest thing that I think that we need is encouragement for students to get involved in the e-discovery world. I was encouraged. I was working at a law firm, and the senior partner came into my office and said, hey, I think you'd be interested in this. And this was 4.5, 5 years ago, and it was an e-discovery newsletter. And from them, it snowballed, and here we are today. It's, I think, you know, just encouraging law students to get involved and to not to think within the box, but to think outside the box. And, you know, it's everything from getting involved with us on a editorial level if they're interested, or just submitting ideas and articles. And the big thing that we need is input or participation from the law school. So for the whether it's attorneys that are listening, that they can, you know, reach out to their local law schools or their alumni network and encourage their law clerks to do so, or whether it's the academic world that's listening and they're able to really facilitate within their institutions at participation. I've talked to a few professors that as soon as I mentioned the idea, they were teaching e-discovery courses, they jumped on it. They said, absolutely, I'll make it, you know,
participation credit or whatever I can to get them involved, because I think it's critical. So just any type of participation, whether it's editorial or whether it's submitting articles and ideas, we're looking for anything right now. I mean, content is what we want the site to be focused about, not Alex and Hunter.
Yeah, and Judge Green, it never can just be Alex and Hunter or Carl or whatever. It's got to be law student driven. I always had this idea, and I wanted to get your reaction, Judge Grimm, of a model where a local law student might join Law Blog Review in a particular market where there's a law school, and then take it upon themselves to meet with the local bar association to let them know for the solo practitioner small law firm section. We have one of those here in Pittsburgh at the Allegheny County Bar Association, that there is this resource that exists. Do you think that's a bad thing for the students to reach out to the legal community and promote?
No, I don't. I think it's even there are ways in which that could be facilitated. I'm not sure if this is done everywhere, but I think it's happening increasingly, and I believe that this is a national trend. But there are lots of inns of court. I know that there are in Maryland, for example, there are half a dozen inns of court, and what they do is they combine members of the bench with practitioners of all levels of experience and from different types of firms, whether they be plaintiffs or defendants, and law students, and that's what's key to them. They're not law clubs where they're all experienced and very prominent lawyers, but they involve in the inns of court, taking on the paradigm of what the British have had for centuries. A notion where they get together once a month. There's generally a dinner, and so there's a social portion of it, and then afterwards they discuss things and they have people present. Usually they meet during what I would refer to as the academic year, from say September to May. So you have about nine of them a year, and what they are specifically geared to do is to integrate in programs and presentations and demonstrations the young lawyers, the law students, to the benefit of the entire collective audience. So one great way of doing that is to find out whether there's an inn of court in your area, and I think probably there are many more. If they're not, then getting one of these inns of courts together, I think there's a national organization that can help with how you do that. Getting an inn of court can be very, very helpful. There's a in Delaware. There's a well-regarded ESI lawyer, Kevin Brady, up there, who I've done a lot of programs with, and as they have in Delaware, a law and technology focus on specifically on ESI matters. Judge Fasciola and I both have had the pleasure of speaking to that inn of court at some of their meetings, and so if you can get an access to the bar that way, That's an automatic right there within the inn of court. And then because there are experienced lawyers, some of those lawyers are bound to be active in the bar association, county, whether it's local bar or city bar or state bar, and know that either through the young lawyers or through the litigation section or for whatever appropriate organization can get the law students there to be able to say, hey, we can make this resource available.
That's great. And I'd also like to give a quick plug to law students that listen to this, that when you're in law school and you're working your way through, if you keep your head down in the book and worry about what you're doing professionally for that firm that comes into your school to interview, to hire you, you may realize too late that that the world only works that way for a very few number of lawyers. And it's harder and harder to get a really good job straight through the interviewing process at a law school. But if you take it upon yourself to build your niche and to market yourself beyond your placement office, you've really enhanced your opportunities. When I was in law school, I went to Carnegie Mellon to get my MBA, and I was a dual degree student at Pitt Law. And there was a recession in 92 when I was there. So I interviewed lawyers who went to Carnegie Mellon. There were only 19 of them in the country. And I wrote an article for the Alumni News, and I got my summer job off of that and got a great opportunity because of it. There's nothing that stops you from joining this and then scheduling a meeting with your local bar association to say, hey, we've got 5 students in law school here, and they're all on the site, and we'd like to help. Then you get a little bit of experience as a law clerk. Now you're building out a track record. But waiting for someone to hand you the job is probably the riskiest strategy. I used to be in placement. You know, I owned a staffing company, so I'm passionate about helping students get jobs. But that's my little bit of advice for what it's worth. Hunter, Alex, this is great. I'm glad you've built this and got it up and going. Do you need any help at all from professionals in the field or, you know, people that are working? Any shout-outs for help, advisory board? I don't know. I mean, I've said I would continue helping you, obviously, but do you want any other help, or you think you're just waiting for the law students?
Well, I think personally one of the greatest things that we could do is set up, you know, kind of a mentorship program if anybody are interested, to be able to sit there and you've got law students that, you know, they want to bounce ideas off of somebody that is in the practicing world or that, you know, is in the litigation support from the e-discovery standpoint that has the background. Somebody that kind of, you know, can introduce people into the industry, and if a student is truly interested in getting into the e-discovery world, to be a resource and kind of a liaison to get there. Anybody that, you know, any established professionals or attorneys that are interested in doing that, we would absolutely welcome their participation and just to be a resource for the students.
Okay. Well, that's about all I had for any questions. Judge Grimm, I don't know if you had any questions for these two students or a last comment or...
No, I think what they've done sort of underscores the point Judge Shinlin was making and that I want to make as well, and that is that you can tell by just hearing the enthusiasm in their voice and how they have collaborated in the process and how they have thought it through and each one of them has sort of been propelled by the experience and the dedication of the other. I think that kind of collaborative approach is much more frequent in young lawyers and young professionals and just in younger people than in the older generation. I know that my son, who's a law student, that there's a lot of networking that they do, and they approach problems in a different way, in a much more collaborative way. I also believe that kind of problem-solving methodology, not only does it help demonstrate capacity and therefore act as the best kind of job interview that you can have, but it also identifies, because they work, skill sets of cooperative approaches to problem solving that the judges have been saying to the bar with increasing frequency and sometimes impatient for the last 10 or 15 years, that you got to approach these in a cooperative, not a combative fashion, because you can spend a fortune of your client's money arguing and combating each other, and that will not produce a good result. The cooperative approach to identify what the information is, and then at that point the adversary system kicks in, is the only way that's going to make any sense. And I think that having heard the approach from these two young law students, is they've demonstrated this collaborative approach to problems, I think, marks a successful lawyer in the future. Marketing that and delivering it and producing the results at a cost-effective way is the way in which they're going to assure their own success, and I think at the same time, their own satisfaction, because as a person who's taught as an adjunct professor for over 20 years, I can tell you this, that the worst thing any professor or law student or law teacher can see is a bright student who is propelled to go to law school by a desire to make a difference. See them years after they've gotten out, if they're in some drudgery job in some place where they're essentially a assembly line worker on fragmented pieces of cases about which they have no ownership, where their problem-solving skills and creativity are not being used, and you just look them in the eye and you know that they're not enjoying what they did. There is many challenging and important legal problems to be solved in the future as we have ever had. Some might say, and I'm one of them, more. And we need creative people who can embrace and use the technology in a way to get to approach these problems on behalf of their clients and the greater good of society. And I think that that what we've seen here, and those who participate in this are going to find that they develop this ability and they have these networks, and it can only be to their own personal advantage, to the advantage of the local bar and the national bar, and the judges will embrace it.
Great. Well, yeah, I wanted to thank you, Judge Grimm, for joining us here at ESI Bites, and also thank Judge Shinlin, who'd called in earlier. It's always a pleasure to have both of you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To Alex and Hunter, and you know, and obviously I'm going to continue helping you with this this exercise, as well as some of the other people. I think Allison Stanton still wants to help out, and some of the others. We wish you the best of luck getting the law students excited about this, and you know, very optimistic about the potential of this now that it's built.
And so, yeah, I think that maybe there's a maybe what you could do is do an article to that you try and get a hold of somebody in one of the ABA publications, and have them do an article on what this project is. If that gets out there in the American Bar Association Journal or one of the other prominent law journals, that this thing's out there, it'll become viral. And you know, along the line, if you build it, people will come. I want to thank you, Carl, for inviting me. I want to say again for my dear friend John Fasciola that he also would have had some of the same thoughts that Judge Shinlin and I expressed with his typical eloquent wit. He is like Judge Shinlin, has always been someone who has argued for competence not only from the lawyers but also from the court as well, because it's a two-way street. So thank you all very much. Carl, I'm going to have to go back to some other matters now, so I thank you for this, and I haven't heard anything on what we've heard today that would cause me to have any pause about it being put up online.
Great, and to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. That's ESI Bites. You can remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bites, the way it sounds out, of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinnaman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Chernov, wishing you a nice day.